Well, good morning, Redemption Church. So as Amy said, tomorrow is St. Paddy's Day, that day where everybody's a little bit Irish, except for us Scots. We're still just Scottish, all right? So I said in the last service, I said, tomorrow when I'm training people at the gym, I'm actually going to wear my kilt tomorrow as a Scotsman, just joining with the Irish a little bit. And then after that, I had a bunch of people going like, well, I'm going to the gym tomorrow. I want to see you in a kilt. If that's what it takes to get you in the gym, all right, that's on you. But looking forward to it. It's going to be fun tomorrow. So enjoy that. And yeah, I'm going to wear a kilt. Why not? I do that every once in a while. So aside from that, hey, welcome to Redemption Church. And as I think about today, I think about a long time ago and a galaxy pretty close by, actually our own, right? We're in a spiral galaxy, average size, on the far end of one of those arms of the spiral. There is a star. We call it the sun. Believe it or not, it's past all these clouds. It's there. And then here on this third rock from the sun, this Earth, we know when we read through the scriptures that God's unfolding cosmic story began in this very unique place. It has this metaphorical significance, this importance to the story. We know this location is Eden. And if you took the idea of Eden, it's more than just a garden. It's like a vector. It's a portal. It is a connecting point, an epicenter of this idea that God started this program, this beautiful thing, where heaven and earth, they overlapped. There was a unification in that space. And so with that, you have kind of like the divine and the human. You have the natural and the supernatural and the spiritual. You have uniqueness. You have utopia. You have opportunity. You have unlimited potential. Like, all of that is in that space known as Eden. And you want to kind of think about it that way, that there was this time where God was working with people, and those people with God and with one another had this relationship where there wasn't hostility and friction and division and hatred and death and all that stuff. No, it just all came together. But then with that story, very quickly in the story, we see that there was a rupture. Not a rapture, a rupture. And this idea of the overlapping of those two realms of heaven and of earth, they became divided, right? Segregated out. And so you had the realm of the blessing of the skies, where then God's agenda dwells. And then you had this idea of hell on earth, this cursed realm of the land. And that's the way the story unfolds. There's this man, this woman, there's this rupture of relationship. And from that, they're expelled. And as they are, you instantly see in the story division, frustration, banter in a negative way. You see kind of jockeying for position. You see the spinning up of envy, of resentment, of bitterness, and of hatred. Like, by chapter 3 of this piece of literature, in the first work of the literature, it all falls apart. And then that becomes sort of the overarching narrative of the great meta-narrative of the scripture. From Genesis all the way to the Book of the 12, those last works of the Hebrew scripture, you have all of that ugly that gets kind of spun up in the environment. Until one day, in a very obscure region, walks this itinerant Nazarene rabbi. And he is a bit of a mystic. He's a little bit of a surprise. He doesn't fit the mold of anything that they anticipate, but he comes with a message. He steps into the darkness so tremendously, it's like light. The shadow of death is pushed away by the essence of this reality of his light. And he says, hey, I want you to think different. I want you to think different about how everything is happening in the world. I want you to think different about how things can be changed in the world. And if I was to take the way that story unfolds, and we had the unity, and then we had the rupture, and we had the division, what you see with Jesus coming in Matthew chapter 3 and Matthew chapter 4 is he's crashing the skies into the land. And he's using the kingdom of heaven to drive out the way of hell. So you have this whole new intersection of this is going to just by sheer weight and force start to press this out. That's the essence of this idea of the kingdom, right? And so with that, I want us to understand, as we're going through the Sermon on the Mount, it's more than Jesus is rolling in. It's like, hey, here's how you don't go to hell. Here's how you go to heaven. Like, that is not so much the driver. The driver is he's like, I am looking for partners. I'm looking for collaborators. I'm looking for those who want to join with me in my mission to bring this think different message of the skies into this harsh realm of the land and bring real sustainable change. Technical, practical, everyday, grassroots, whatever you want to call it, change that can fundamentally change everything. That's really the heart. Thus, what I would say for us is that he has us kind of rolling into the business of being displacers. In fact, Jesus talks about this with Peter. So Peter and he are hanging out with the other fellows, and Peter says something dumb, because that's what Peter does, and Jesus corrects him, and he says, listen, dude, I'm building a community of faith. We're going to call it the church, and this thing is going to crash the gates of hell. Now, when he says that, a lot of times we think that what he's saying is, I'm going to build this gate around the church, and then hell can't break down the gates. That's not the metaphor. The metaphor is the church is the gate crasher. In other words, it's slamming into the curse of the earth, and it's driving out all that hell in the land. Like, that's the picture you want to have there. And so from that, what I would say, if I kind of captured all of this, is that when each of us live the way of the kingdom, we displace earth's curse with heaven's blessing. Thus the Sermon on the Mount, all of this thinking different means to live upside down and backwards from the norm that we see, so as to see the kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And so I use this picture here because I want you to think that way. Like, when we're going through the Sermon on the Mount, when you do it, when you live it, when you own it, wherever you're at as you're doing that thing, it's like this displacing agent. You're doing it outside of the way business is done. You're showing love in a way that most people don't anticipate, and forgiveness and grace, and you're just creating a little pocket of heaven on earth that way, and that's the way you make the difference. That's how you displace this ugly with the beauty. And so Jesus' words in this sermon are more than just Christian ethics. I want us to really own that they're about restoration, reconciliation, global transformation, where when we live these upside-backwards things, we're partnering in that process to see Jesus' transformation in the lives of people, so that people come into relationship with him, and then it just continues to spin up from there. So that's what I want to keep before us as we get ready to go into today. Now, as we do, I want to remind you that we have an app, and in the app there are notes. That's the first thing you can follow along with. The second thing is next week we're going to have a hot seat Q&A, so it's Stump the Pastor Sunday, and with that, you can text any question you want. Doesn't matter what it is, you can text any question you want to that number right there. I don't see those in advance. Scott will read those in real time, and then we'll see what falls out of my face, all right? But I want to take some opportunity to say, hey, you might have a lot of questions from what we've done so far in the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to take those kind of first, and then any other questions you have, we'll cycle in behind. But I want to make sure we're kind of creating some space for that. So that's going to be next week. A lot of fun, and I haven't done one for a while, so it's going to be all the better to kind of do it now. So with that said, I'm going to pray for us this morning, kind of get us settled, and then we're going to jump right into business. Jesus, I thank you that you invite us not to easy living, but to hard living. And I thank you in that it's more than just, hey, this makes me a good person in the eyes of God. It's more like this is the only thing that makes a real difference in the instabilities of our world. It's the only thing that is how we are partnering with you to fulfill the prayer that we have that we'll see in chapter 6 of we're praying for your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. We're not just like waiting around for that. We seek it and we also do it as you are bringing it. And so help us to just own all of that and help us to want your best and to kind of rid ourselves of our worst, because I'm really good at my worst. And I don't want to be better at your best. And so help us to do all of those things. And so we look to you to guide us today and teach us in your kind of good name. Amen. So Jesus rolls in, says, look up, turn around, think different. That's the word repent. Think different. Heaven is crashing into earth. And with that, the skies are pushing back the curse of the land. So he's given now his Sermon on the Mount. First thing Jesus did is he blessed upside-down dispositions. That was the Beatitudes. Then from there, he stated upside-down objectives, right? You're to be salt and light and a city on a hill. Then he's emphasized upside-down rightness, right? You have a righteousness, a right by othersness that is greater than religion, greater than the scribes and the Pharisees and the mucky mucks. You got to have something different in your lives. And so from this, he then illustrates how to live this. How to really be right by others, and I would say the ethos of that is love that displaces the curse. Like, the greatest commandment is the tool by which we bring that displacement. And so based on that, then Jesus starts to lay out like 6 case studies. Like, he's like, I'm going to give you an example of this, and of this, and of this, and of this. And all of these are meant to get us kind of thinking. They're not the be-all, end-all. He's like using these 6, and he's like, you can think of dozens of others. But it's all driven through that idea of love God, love your neighbor. That's the way this is all healed. And we noted it last week in the case studies that there's an interesting structure to the way this section of Matthew's laid out. So we said there's bookends. And in chapter 5, verses 17 to 20, he's like, hey, man, there's a greater right by othersness that I want you to pursue. a greater one. And then at the very end of the chapter, he's going to be like, and when you do these kinds of things, you complete that righteousness. You're perfect because your Father's perfect. So those are the bookends. Now when he goes into the case studies, those two kind of have their own types of bookends. He's going to open up with the first one, which is, hey man, let's deal with hatred toward a friend. And then the last one is, let's deal with love toward an enemy. And then there's stuff in between. But I love the juxtaposition there. You wouldn't typically think hate and a friend, and you wouldn't think love and an enemy, but Jesus is he's brilliant in how he structures things, just to get us thinking, just to get us processing all of this. And so he goes into his first case study. He says, you have heard that our ancestors were told, you must not murder. And if you commit murder, you are subject to judgment. Now, stop right there for just a second, because here's what's nice about that. We hear that, it's in the top 10, and most of us go, sweet, I'm not a murderer. I like where Jesus is going. We joked last week about PGPs, right? Pretty good people. We're all pretty good people. So we're like, man, I've never murdered anybody. Jesus and I are on the same page. In fact, I was doing the math this week, right? So there's about 347 million Americans. And in 2022, there was roughly about 22,000 plus murderers in the country. What that means is 99.9939% of us, not a murderer. Well done, everybody. Why don't you give a little knuckle bump to your neighbor right now? Like, hey, no murderer, didn't murder anybody, not yet. Right? Now, if somebody didn't knuckle bump you just now, I would get a space away, just a chair length away, you know, maybe two arm lengths, whatever it is. Like, okay, not sure about you. You didn't pass a knuckle bump. There might be something. I don't know. But we all feel pretty good about that. Not a murderer, like where Jesus is going. But then he says, but I say to you, if you are even angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. Oh, Jesus, he's pesky, man. Like, really, dude? You're getting in my interior. You're getting into my thought process, what's going on in my heart. Do you really need to mess with my insides like that? Is that fair? Now, I get it. Some of you maybe, though, are like, I'm still good. Like, you're saying that, but I'm not angry. I'm not an angry person. I don't get angry at stuff. I don't feel angry now. You might even be like, hey, we just had a little music set. I have my moment of zen, if you will. Like, I'm just feeling calm, at ease, at peace. I feel no angst in me. I'm going to see if I can change that. Let's bring up these six pictures right here. All right, so you're welcome. So I went to AI, which is like the deep think of our generation. Thank you, Hitchhiker's Guide. And I said, who are the top 10 people Americans most hate right now? These are the top six of the top 10. And I figured because it was kind of an even split politically, I had a good chance that everybody was going to be mad at one of these people looking at them on the screen. I was just covering all my bases. Now you might be like, I'm not angry yet. But what if I said, oh, Nancy Pelosi? I love Nancy Pelosi. Now you're like, now I'm mad. Now I'm angry, not at her, but at you, you dirtbag, right? Or if I'm like, oh, that Trump, man, I love that Trump. Elon, what he's doing with that chainsaw, woo, love it. Now you're like, I'm really mad. Zuckerberg, internet was made for that genius, man. I love that genius. Like, we all feel like you're like, my palms are getting sweaty, my eyes starting to twitch, you know, like I feel it. And see, that's the thing. For us as Americans, like, we struggle with this anger thing. It's just in us. As all human beings, it's in us. In fact, again, I went to Copilot this week. I said, what are the top 10 things that Americans are most angry about right now? And you read the list, and I went with Roy Kent, because, man, gotta love Roy Kent, right? Angriest man on television. Love my Roy Kent. So, political polarization. Yeah, right? Economy, you bet. LGBTQ plus issues, social justice. Depending on what side you're on, anger, both sides. Gun violence or gun control or gun excess, I mean, anger. So when we look at these things, we know, like, it's just in us. It's this trigger that can pull really, really easy. And then some of that, it is even closer to home. Like, we talk about all these kind of national things or cultural things, but even closer to home, you might be like, yeah, this week, my wife and I, we were fighting. My kid and I, we were fighting. I was fighting with my boss. I was fighting with a coworker. I was fighting with somebody underneath me. I was angry at this person, angry at that person, angry at this teacher for what they did with my kid, whatever it is. Like, even today, get into the car to go to church, and there might have been some tension. You're like, we were just trying to go to Starbucks to get coffee, but Dad can't make the order because three of us are giving him orders. He gets confused. He gets mad, and we all got water, and then we drove to church mad, you know? Because that's what happens with guys. Don't give me too many orders at Starbucks. I freak out. Y'all get black coffee, drink it, and you'll be happy. That's all you get, you know? That's what my kids make fun of me for, at least. I don't get angry. I just get agitated. I get electrified, if you will. But that's the problem, right? And we all know this. We've all experienced it. We've had something said to us. We've had something said about us. We've had something directed our way. And even maybe in that, it was something that happened a long time ago, and everybody else has forgotten, but you still carry it with you. Those are all those things of anger. And to that, Jesus says, and if you are even angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. Ouch, man. Ouch. Now, I know when reading this, here's what I know about our human nature, because I have it too. We go, Jesus said this thing. The first thing I got to do is find the exception to the thing he said. Like, there's a rule. Where's the exception? Where's the trap door that says, I know this is true, but how do I get away with not having to do that? Because that's too difficult. Like, whatever it is, like, we have that thing in us. And so it really comes down to this. Typically, when I talk to people about anger and I say, well, Jesus says this, I always go, but, what about righteous anger? That's always the go-to. What about, though, this case for righteous anger? Can't one be good and angry? That's the question. I want to wrestle with that for a second. Can we be good and angry? Here's my answer. Generally, no. Occasionally, yes. Generally, no, and occasionally, yes. Here's the thing I'm going to tell you about my relationship to the Bible. I really believe that at its core, it's there to generate wisdom, right? Like, that's really the central thing that it's doing in our life. It's this generation of wisdom. And when it comes to anger, I realize when you're talking about righteous anger and this whole thing, you need genuine wisdom. You need humility and thoughtfulness and nuance in there, because anger is an interesting thing. And so with this, I would say generally, anger is more trouble than it's worth. Generally speaking, I think anger is more trouble than it's worth. And you just go through, again, kind of the story of the Bible. You got Cain, clearly a bad idea, what he did with his anger. You've got Joseph's brothers, you got Esau, Moses. When you read the story of Moses, oftentimes, you know when Moses got in trouble? When he lost his cool. That's when things go bad. When he's chill, it's good. When he flips out, it's bad. Saul, same problem. Jonah, same problem. Now, you may be like, well, I haven't done a lot of my Sunday school stuff lately, so I'm not sure about all those stories and names. Here's a different one. Just pick the last 10 fights you've had with somebody. How did anger serve you? Good or poorly? Like, I had one this week. My wife and I had a really wonderful fight about sliding barn doors. And she's like, I don't think they're level. And I'm like, they're level, Ellen. They just drift one way on purpose, you know? And like she's like, no, but I don't think, and it was like, and I, like, it instantly, I was defensive, instantly, I was angry, and I don't, like, yell. I just get, like, pensive, difficult, you know? And I'm like, did not serve me well. 3 hours later, was not a great use of our time, all right? So, and you know that one. We've all experienced that, right? Anger doesn't tend to make things better. It usually makes things worse. In fact, Ecclesiastes 7 says it this way. Control your temper, for anger labels you a fool. Now, when we hear fool, we go, oh, you mean like a dummy dumb or whatever it is. Now, in their world, a fool had a lot of depth to it, right? So in wisdom literature of the Hebrew scriptures, it was to be reckless and ruleless and senseless and kind of dangerous in what you do. So like a fool is a really unstable personality. And so he's like, man, you don't want to get angry because it just makes you look like a fool. It plays the fool around everybody that you're in proximity to. In fact, tagging off of this, James, who's the little brother to Jesus, said this. He said, human anger does not produce the righteousness God desires. Usually, just produces self-righteousness. Which that last part, that's the MBV, Matt Boswell version, but I want to put it in there. Because I realize in my own life, that's usually what's happening. Like when I go, I got the righteous anger, it's really just self-righteous anger, and it's not healthy. And what I dig about what James is doing there is he's building commentary off of his brother, right? So Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, you need to have a righteousness that's greater than the scribes and Pharisees, and James is rolling in behind that and saying, I'll tell you what derails that, what suppresses real right by others-ness, righteousness, is anger. It's like, so this is why you don't want to go down that road. It will just ultimately mess you up. Perhaps this is why Paul states emphatically, get rid of, ditch, kick to the curb, punt, whatever word you want to use. Get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger, harsh words, and slander, as well as all types of evil behavior. Just get rid of it, ditch it, be done with it. Now, I'm sure some of you are hearing this right now, and you're thinking, Matt, I'm getting very energized by you with all of this, right? And yeah, I hear you and I get it, but I think, come on, there's got to be a time and a place because, and this is always where it goes, because Jesus got angry. Jesus got angry, Matt. You're saying, I can't, but Jesus was righteous. Jesus got, can't I do that too? And now here's what I'm going to say. Yes, occasionally, Jesus displayed righteous anger. So let's break that out for just a second. Let's look where he did that. First, we see he did it on behalf of others. So there's a scene in the Gospel of Mark. This dude is in the synagogue. He's got a withered hand, and it's the Sabbath day. And the religious leaders, because they're just mucky muck punks, they're watching this scene, and they're like, oh, Jesus is going to heal this guy, and that's going to be a real sin to see a miracle in the synagogue. How awful is that, right? So this guy gets healed, and they're like, there it is. But Jesus knows that that's their attitude, and so he's angry at their self-righteous, arrogant, uncompassionate, uncaring, just ick inside. So in that sense, yeah, he has a righteous anger on behalf of others. The other is we see that Jesus had a righteous anger at injustice against others, right? So this is like the whole flipping tables in the temple thing, right? Where, again, instead of this place being a house for prayer for all the nations, instead of the poor having equal access as the rich to the worship of God, they're monetizing it all. It's just corrupt because religion loves to just make things toxic that are meant to be beautiful. And so Jesus sees this, and he's angry at all this injustice, and he's flipping the tables, right? So yeah, he's angry there. You know the time that Jesus wasn't angry? His own self-defense. He doesn't do it. Luke chapter 22. You read this whole chapter. His friend betrays him. His other friends ditch him. His nation crucifies him. The soldiers beat him. The crowds cheer for his death. And in all of it, you know what he does? Forgive them. He says, God, forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing. He could have been like, I'm getting off this cross. I'm going to kick your face in. Like, he could have done any of that. Like, I'm just angry. But he doesn't do that. He's like, no, when it's him, he doesn't get worked up about the injustice toward him. He gets worked up about the injustice toward others. Here's why I think this is kind of important, this idea here to understand where he does it and how he directs it is, I remember, especially during the pandemic online, I would see a lot of people bringing up table flipping Jesus, right? When they were mad about something, they'd be like, and I'm allowed to be angry because Jesus flipped tables. I'm like, yeah, table flipping Jesus, which I've decided should be like crying out loud. We should use it that way, like table flipping Jesus. But like, it's a new phrase of mine. I'm going to throw it around a lot. So, but people would do this, and I'm like, listen, Jesus didn't flip tables because he was mad he couldn't get a beer because he didn't have a vax card. That's not why he was flipping tables. Right? I would see people getting mad about all the social stuff. They're like, and Jesus flipped the tables. I'm like, Jesus flipped the tables because there was true injustice against marginalized people, and he wasn't going to tolerate that. But his own stuff, his personal stuff, he didn't get into that. So if it's for a righteous cause, sure. If it's a relationship to another's injustice, sure. But it was never in the quest to just defend or advance his own defense or cause. And so that's even for me. I'm like, sure, I would love to be like, I'm flipping social tables because Jesus did. And I got to slow my roll and go, wait, maybe there's a lot of reasons I want to do it that I shouldn't do it. Now, with this, I want to be honest about the reality of anger, because it's just a switch. It's your amygdala is like, we're going to flip it, man. It's just a chemical biological reaction when you have this initial fight or flight response. That's a natural thing. And so with that, I think that can play a positive role. If we're really wise, because again, we're trying to use wisdom in this, if we're wise, I would say that yes, anger can have its initial place, but it can't and shouldn't be its resting place. Or you could even say nesting place would even work. So let me give you the positive role, right? So something happens. Somebody says something, does something, whatever it is. And your first response, anger. Natural. Understandable. It's going to happen for every one of us at some point, probably in the next 2 hours, right? You're going to feel it somehow. Out on the road, something happens, whatever it is. From that, here's where it should go. This is going to be the positive where it should go. It should go to grief and lament. When you feel that thing, where you want to go is grief and lament, because you're remembering, hey, the world has this curse problem. We all come against one another. Heaven is crashing into earth. And what I want to do is realize that, this mess we're in, all of this toxic crud, it's because we're all broken. We're all wounded. We all have this stuff. And instead of being mad about it, I want to be sad about it. I want to have lament. I want to have grief over it. And when you have that, then where you want to move is to trying to come up with a way to solve the problem. Like, okay, now I'm not just trying to retaliate. I'm trying to reconcile. I'm trying to course correct it in a different kind of way. And so in that sense, anger can have an appropriate triggering effect to everything else, right? You just don't want it to lead to embittered action. But you want it to be that thing of like, okay, this is giving me an impetus to be sad about these realities and then begin to solve the problems. I love what Psalm 4 says. It says, don't sin by letting anger control you. Think about it overnight and remain silent. Like, that could just be a hard stop right there. Like, here, if I modernize this, fine. Write the email and then hit delete, you know? Don't hit send. Write the text, hit delete. Don't hit send. Think about it. I love what it says in Ephesians chapter 4. Do not sin by letting anger control you. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry. For anger gives foothold to the devil. So he's like, man, you can have an initial reaction. You can have an initial thought of that. Hold that for a little bit. Don't speak to it. And then wait. But don't let it linger. And that can be an initial helpful thing. But if you let it rest, if you let it nest, it's a different gig. So now let's say you have anger. And anger has this potential for a root in the heart, right? Like, it starts to affect and infect your motivations. It starts to get deep inside, a poisonous root, Hebrews 12 says. And that poisonous root, it calls it bitterness. Bitterness. And you've probably felt it. I know I felt bitterness before. But here's the trick, right? I'm going to give you the formula a little bit. When you have anger and it's leading to bitterness, what happens is they start to feed one another. So it cycles. Anger leads to bitterness. Bitterness leads to more anger leads to more bitterness. And pretty soon you're in the flywheel, man. You're in the spiral flat spin of death when it comes to, oh, I'm feeling it. And you know that thing. You're like driving in your car and you're thinking about it. And pretty soon you're just talking out loud to yourself. And if they were here, I would tell them this. Well, I guess if they were here, I wouldn't really say that, but if they were, I would. You know? And you have that thing. You're in the shower and you're just starting to wash your hair really hard because you're thinking about them. Except for me, I'm just shining it, right? So, but you're like, dude, they do this and they do that. And I can't believe it. I tell them, and you know, like we all know those times and places and spaces where we feel that kind of stuff, right? What that will all lead to is ultimately resentment, and even the desire for revenge, right? That's just kind of where it goes. Either I hate them inside, or I tell everybody about how they suck. That's our version of revenge, right? That's just what we all kind of tend to go toward. Right? That's just the stuff of brokenness, of friction. We all face it, we all feel it. What's interesting here is Jesus is trying to crash into all of that with the way of the skies. He's just trying to cancel that whole cycle. That's what he's trying to get ahead of. So there's a time and a place for anger that can be used for good things, but often it goes to toxic things. So from this, he is then going to tell us a truth about anger that probably will make most of us a little angry. We'll be like, I hear it, kind of like it, kind of bugs me. Here's what he says more in his entirety. You've heard that it was told to our ancestors, the ancients, that you must not murder, and if you commit murder, you'll be subject to judgment. But I say to you that even if you're angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. If you call someone raka, you're in the danger of being brought before the court. And if you call someone a fool, you're in the danger of the fires of Gehenna. And so he gives these three illustrations about how we vent our vexation. Right? Anger, raka, fool. And they're kind of an escalator, right? So we have it on the screen. Anger is like an issue that kind of fires you up, and it's just like, hey, somebody did something, and that's the thing, and I feel this thing. That usually then escalates to this idea of raka. It's an Aramaic word. It just probably means like idiot or blockhead or something like that. But you're insulting their mind there. How can they think like this? How can they process? How can they see the world this way? And then you go, oh, I know what it is. It comes because of the fact that they're a fool. Again, they're immoral in their world. A fool was a degenerate, right? So it insults their character. And we all get this. Like, we understand, you made me mad. I can't believe you think this way. Oh, I know why you think this way. Because you're just not a good person. You just don't have integrity. That's what it is. And that word raka, I particularly like that one because it has like a tone to it. Like, it sounds feisty. Raka, you know? And I think we do that with some of the stuff in our world, right? Like, you go like, Trump, raka, right? All those gay pride things raka. Immigrants, raka. Democrats, raka. Conservatives, raka. Whatever it is, man. Healthcare, raka. Hollywood, raka. Aaron Rodgers, raka. You know what? Doesn't pick the thing. We have that thing, and it's like, I don't like that raka. Social media is a rockapalooza right now. It's just everybody's rocking everybody else, right? It's just like, wow, I'm going to go watch the fights. It's called Facebook. It's so fun, right? But that's what happens, right? And some of this stuff even hits closer to home, right? In, like, maybe in your marriage, like, there's a little bit of, like, you're so spun up with one another. It's like, you have a fight, and it's like, rocka, just with your parents. Rocka my parents, man. Just rock you. Right? That could be the sense. Maybe even in your world right now, you're like, hey, I'm in an escalator where it started off as anger that was like mild, but it's moving toward Diablo, you know? Like, it's made that red lid that's really hot and that burns your face off. Like that may be the anger that you're starting to roll through. It's when we go, I'm hurt, and I'm going to inflict some hurt from my hurt, right? There's always a spectrum there. There's a scale, but it's the stuff we battle with. And normally, in those spaces, we see what the consequence of that is. Like, the way we picture, you've hurt me, and I'm going to hurt you back, and here's the consequence in our world. It's that basically everybody now knows that that person sucks. I've let everybody know that they suck because they're a nitwitted, imbecilic degenerate. Like, you may not use those words, right? But that's what happens a lot. Like, that's what slander is or gossip is or whatever it is. It's like, I'm going to throw you under the bus because you hurt me, and I'm going to let all those people know that that's you. And that's how we handle consequence. And so normally we think like the consequence is something that happens to them where we're like, you know what, don't light this firecracker unless you want to get burned, you know? Like, that's our thing. And then we burn them and we think, ah, they got the burn. But Jesus says, nah, it actually falls into your lap. He says the real consequence isn't that. It's if you're angry, you're subject to judgment. If you say raka, you're in danger of being brought before the court. If you call somebody a fool, you're in danger of the fires of Gehenna. Again, it's another escalating idea. So the local court is the first one, like their supreme court, the Sanhedrin is the second one, and then the Valley of Hinnom is the third one. And this was like a southwest valley to the city of Jerusalem, and it was kind of known in the Hebrew scriptures as like the most deplorable place. This is where the worst times in Israel's history would happen, in that valley, and they'd start to sacrifice their children to the other gods, and just terrible things happened there. So it always became the symbol of the most sinister and dark and judgmental of spaces. It's like the worst place kind of thing. And if you simplified kind of what Jesus is getting at here, is he's like, when you go down this road and you let anger eat you up and you go to those places, it is a bit like the ultimate outcome or the exercise of that is you're going to be unleashing hell on everything. It's going to unleash hell in the entire community. It's going to unleash hell in your own life. It's going to unleash hell in the lives of others. It's going to be this terrible, destructive force. As hell is, so hell does. Later, Jesus' little brother, again, James, writes about the tongue being like hell. Our words unleashing the fires of hell. Like, he's, again, building off his brother here. James is just kind of writing on the Sermon on the Mount. And that's the essence of what's going to happen. And so I think it's fitting that hell is the result of those who unleash it. Like, that's kind of Jesus just using this really powerful hyperbole, and it's shocking and it should be sobering. We're like, okay, I don't want to just blow off, like my anger is no big deal. It's like, no, it's kind of one of the biggest deals. So the question for all of us today is, what do we do with all of the anger, the insults, the character assassination that's rolling around in our head and our hearts and our conversations and our culture at large? Like, how do we begin to tackle that whole thing? Now, what I think is interesting is in Jesus's world, this was a question that they had been wrestling with for 200 years before Jesus, very actively, right? So some of the thinkers and writers, rabbinical kind of scholars of the time, had been really working this through because they were thinking back to Israel's history, and they're like, man, we do angry stuff, and then God takes us to the woodshed, and then we get course corrected, but then we get angry again, either at the poor or the outsiders or whatever, and God spanks us again, and there's a cycle of anger. And so they're wrestling through, how can we stop being so enslaved to our anger? That's what they were wanting to figure out. So different writers were coming up with different things. Some writers said, it's reason. We just need to be logical, and from that, using our logic to overcome our emotional responses. In other words, they're the first Vulcans, right? So, like, Spock would have loved that guy. Like, that's right, just get rid of all of the emotion through logic. Others said, we just need to sing more worship songs. Others said, we need to give more alms to the poor. Others said, no, we just need to use meditation. That's going to be the thing. Others said, we just need to learn to suppress all of this. Just crush it down so we don't feel anything. So lots of different thoughts. But then Jesus rolls in with this really novel tract that I'm not sure why people weren't bringing it up, because you actually see echoes of it in the Hebrew scriptures. but he's going to promote this idea. I'm calling this the rough but right by otherness work of reconciliation. Like, here's the thing. In other words, he's like, it's not going to be you think it away, you drive it away, you distrust it away, you distract it away. You just go to war within yourself way, because that's probably one of the ways I would think. It's like, oh, I got an anger problem. I'm just going to fight it inside of me. Now, later, he's going to get into a little thing about turning the other cheek. That might be a little bit of that. But that's not where he's going to go here. And he's also not going to be like, yeah, just accept anger. It happens. Try to just deal with the fallout as best you can. He doesn't do that. Now, he's like, here's the thing I'm going to ask you to do. I'm going to ask you to go to the person that you're angry with. Or there's somebody angry at you. I'm going to ask you to go to the person that's angry with you and try to fix it. Crazy, right? In other words, we're not going to just fake it till we make it. We're actually going to press in. We're going to get uncomfortable. We're going to attempt to do this peacemaking thing. We're going to attempt diplomacy in our relationships. He's like, that's the way you most fix it. That's the way you get closest to solving it. And so from that, he gives these two little sub-case studies to this first case study. One is about the church. One is about the court. First, he says, if you are presenting a sacrifice at the altar at the temple and you suddenly remember that someone has something against you, leave your sacrifice at the altar, go and be reconciled to that person, and then come and offer your sacrifice to God. Two interesting things I want to note here. First of all, it's that idea of reconciled. Literally means a cross exchange. A cross exchange. So when you're reconciling, you're not trying to win, you're trying to win over. You're trying to share some vulnerability, you're trying to maybe gain some vulnerability, and you're trying to come to that place of solution, conclusion, connection, right? Even conciliate, the word conciliate, so reconciliate. Conciliate just means to shout over, not shout at, shout over and say, come over here, let's connect. And in this case, it may be, hey, come over here, let's reconnect because we got disconnected and now we want to do things differently. This is true both for people that we are angry at or they're angry at us. If we're angry at them, it means this approaching in humility and intention that's not being like, I'm gonna tell you why you suck and here's the 20 reasons why. It's saying, you've hurt me, but I want us to connect again. How do we do that? Is it possible? Or if you know you've hurt somebody, you've done the wrong thing, going, or maybe you're like, I don't even know what I did, but I know they're really mad at me and they won't even give me the time of day. I gotta figure this out. And taking that risk, I mean, it's hard. We'll get into maybe some, quote, exceptions to that rule. But again, that can be really hard, but that's where Jesus is pointing us, right? That's the first thing. The second thing that I think is really interesting here is he uses the context of the most sacred act of worship in their world as the context, right? So you travel from wherever you live, you get to Jerusalem, then you get yourself an animal, a goat or whatever it is, and you're standing in line waiting to give it to a priest who's going to give the sacrifice on the altar. And while you're standing in line, you suddenly realize like, oh yeah, Ted. I can't stand Ted. That dude sucks, right? And he's like, okay, here's what you do. You leave line with your animal, give it to somebody, mount your donkey, you ride how many hours, days, weeks, whatever, back home. You find Ted. Hey, Ted, we're not getting along. Got to make this right. Work it all out. When it's all settled and done, back on your donkey, back to Jerusalem, get your animal, back in line at the back, and you're going again. That's very inconvenient, right? That's a lot of effort, a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of energy. And Jesus is like, yeah. Yeah, it matters that way. But even more importantly to me, I go, it matters so much that he's like, hey, stop your worship to go be right with another person. Stop your worship of God to go be right with another person. Here's why this is a big deal. I put it this way. Being in a right relationship with God is entangled with being in a right relationship with others. Being in a right relationship with God is entangled with being in a right relationship with others. Now, add more time. I had this awesome illustration using quantum entanglement to describe this, and I'm like, oh, it's right there and I can't use it. But the idea is basically like particles get entangled and they have this dynamic relationship to one another that really can't be altered. It's an upspin, downspin. Anyway, you know, Einstein called it spooky. It's fun. Anyway, all of that to say, I can get really nerdy really fast. So all of that to say that that same idea of our relationships to people and our relationship to God is equally entangled, so much so that being wrong here makes me in a wrong relationship here, because they bear God's image, And so when I'm not liking on that image, but I claim to love this image, God's like, we're entangled. The three of us are entangled. We all have an interlocking relationship to one another. So in that sense, he's like, man, you want to make sure you're making things right. Otherwise, you're going to kind of be in the wrong with all this when it comes to your spiritual exercise. Therefore, I'd say we are better off ceasing our religious devotion to make right our relational breakdowns so as to maintain our worship. Otherwise, we're going to be wrong before God. Like that, it's uncomfortable. It is. But like even Peter talks about these, like, hey, husbands, if you're not handling your wives well, your prayers are hindered. Like, that's weird. But that's the entangled thing. We can't escape it, right? And so Jesus just really, man, he puts an exclamation point on that, right? You got to try to fix it as much as possible. Next, he talks about civic life. He says, when you're on the way to the court with your adversary, so clearly we know the relationship, he says, settle your difference quickly. Now, this is a little more niche, right? So it's, again, it's an environment where you're suing somebody, they're suing you, there's some kind of property dispute, whatever it is. As soon as lawyers are involved, things get spicy, gets a little crazy. So Jesus gives some real practical advice. He's like, as soon as you're starting to go down that road, try to find some common ground before you get to court. Right? Do whatever you can do to kind of meet in the middle and solve things. He says, otherwise, your accuser may hand you over to the judge, who will hand you over to the officer, and you'll be thrown into prison. And if that happens, you surely won't be free again, and you have paid the last penny. Here's his ultimate point. We are better off seeking to reconcile as quickly as possible before things escalate and the fallout becomes worse. It's pretty simple advice. Now, I'll tell you real practically on this. It may not go perfectly. You may not get, quote, everything you want. Like, so let's say you go to this person and you're gonna be like, you really hurt me. And what you want is, you wanna see them grovel and weep and offer you $1,000 and restitute you, whatever you want, right? Like, you know, you wanna say, and you might not get all of that, but if you get something that like still is a healing thing, you're like, I want the healing thing most of all. I wanna give it my best shot, right? That's the heart, right? Because again, like I said, it may not go exactly the way you would want, but you're ultimately bringing the issue to closure. And if you can bring it to closure, authentic closure, both in your heart and in the dynamic of the relationship, that can bring peace. And kind of we want peace in our conflicts. And if you can get there, it's a bonus, right? So Jesus is just real practical, giving examples. He could give another 50 examples, but these are just examples to start stirring our wisdom to think about the importance of peacemaking in the midst of conflict. Now, as a final note, as we're wrapping up here, here's what I know, practically speaking. Not all attempts at reconciliation work, right? They don't always work. Like, you may go, you may try, and it doesn't work, or you may go, and they go, pound sand, not talking to you, I hate you, go away. But it can happen. It can happen. Some people are just not going to be forgiving, or some people are not going to be receiving, or whatever it is, all right? I would say this. That's okay. That's okay. If you go and you try and you give it your best and it gets shut down, that's okay. Paul says this in Romans, never pay back evil with more evil. Do things in such a way that everyone can see that you are honorable. Do all that you can. Do all that you can to live in peace with everyone. It's just as much as you can do. I go back to week 4. We gave this graphic here on Blessed are the Peacemakers. And we said, you know, once you get outside of that yellow line, that's unhealthy peacemaking. That's the kind of ways that people just force other people. We don't want to go into those spaces. But I would say in this, if you go to somebody, or let's say you don't even have to go yet. You go, they wronged me, but I'm just going to be chill. I'm going to turn the other cheek. I'm cool with it. I don't harbor bitterness. I'm not mad. I'm just going to let it go. That's fine. Right? But you also may go, hey, it just comes down to forgiveness. That's the way I just forgive you or you forgive me. And we get to that place and that's awesome. Let's say you can't get there, and they won't negotiate, and they won't meet, and they won't talk. A boundary's okay. A boundary's okay. Don't set a boundary because you're angry, and you're punitive, and you just want to punish them, and because you want them to know, I don't like you, and so the boundary is set. It's like, I love you enough to set the boundary because I don't want continuing escalation and friction, but I realize if we can't talk, we can't fix, and I've tried as best I can, and you're closed off to it, but I get it, and so I'm just going to set the boundary. That is an okay place to be too, because again, it's decelerating the sense of anger. Not always ideal, not always fun, but certainly permissible and sometimes necessary in the things of life. And so with all of that, I end with three diagnostic questions for all of us. First, What offense am I holding on to that's hurting others, myself, or God? Right? Because all of that could be true. Next, what hurts have I inflicted or had inflicted on me that I need to go and try to make things right? Or maybe you go, I'd better just set a boundary, a healthy, loving boundary, right? And then last, who am I cursing in my heart or words that God is asking me to bless? Because we probably all have that person, that thing, that circumstance, that memory, whatever, kind of eats us up. And God's like, man, I want to let you go. I want to free you up from that to lead into my way to bring my kingdom in this cursed earth. Let's pray together. Jesus, again, I started with saying, hey, I thank you that you ask us to do hard things. This is hard things. Now, you just jump right into the deep end like you're expecting us all to be baby and ninjas that swim to the side and like we're getting after it. Like, it's hard. And we have some deep wounds. We have some real offenses that have come our way. And all the more, it is hard to deal with the hurt, the anger, maybe the bitterness of those things. I'm asking for your grace in that. I'm asking for us to help us remember that, man, like all humans are messy. And that from that, we would err on the side of grace because we know all humans are messy. Whether we're chilling, we're forgiven, or boundary setting, whatever it is, like that we would be more of that. And so Jesus, we thank you again that you love us and you're growing us and you push us and that you ask us to partner in your great experiment, this reclamation project. May we bring the kingdom of the skies to the mess of the land.